Hello and welcome to Our Radio, a community service brought to you by the Low Vision Resource Center. I am Dee, and for the next half hour, I will be reading articles from the Oprah magazine. It's been a long couple of months, and even as some states begin easing restrictions, many Americans are continuing to quarantine alone. But experts take pains to make clear, aloneness doesn't have to equal loneliness. To help anyone navigating these uncharted waters alone, the team here at Oprah Magazine brings you a series of articles from science-proven tips to words of wisdom from people who have endured serious isolation-related loneliness and made it through even stronger. Read on, and at the end of each day that feels like a year, remind yourself, we're all alone in this together. Voices of Solitude. Article 1. I survived 20 days in solitary confinement. Here's how I got through. By Jacqueline Velez, May 5th, 2020. Solitude never frightened me. In fact, I welcomed it. When I was a girl, I would envision myself in a cabin in the woods or a house with a view of a lake or river, doing what I love to do most, writing. I never dreamed I'd be forced into a small enclosure with cold concrete floors and walls made of cinder blocks, where the stench of sour milk, or maybe decomposing carcasses, lingered throughout the facility. A putrid odor, and inescapable and abominable as the notorious Rikers Island itself. The stink was worse in solitary confinement, or as we call it, the being or the box. It was there, where the rotting smell is strongest, that I spent the most important 20 consecutive days of my life. Before the being, when I was still incarcerated with the general population of women at Rikers, I would lie on my stomach and gaze out the long narrow window next to my bunk to admire the Empire State Building. The multicolored lights were changed almost daily to commemorate a holiday or raise awareness for a social issue. A fact I had been oblivious to back in Brooklyn. Back home, we'd go to the rooftops on Star Street to smoke blunts and guzzle 40s of Old English or St. Ives malt liquor, far from the eyes of Jakes, the police officers who constantly harassed us on the streets below for selling heroin or loitering with 40s in our hands. Lying on my prison bunk, I wondered why I had never gone to see the Empire State Building. Its iconic profile now filled me, a born New Yorkerican who never visited New York City landmarks with hope. I had a fantasy of meeting the man of my dreams on the 102nd floor, like Deborah Kerr and Cary Grant in the film An Affair to Remember. She was right when she said the Empire State Building was the closest thing to heaven in the city. Imagining myself there made me doubt that there is an underworld of fire and brimstone our condemned souls travel through when we die. But that was all before I was consigned to my very own 6x9-foot hell box. When I first arrived to the being, the sobs and screeches of women in the cells around me sent chills throughout my body. It sounded like the solitude was eating them alive. Was I also going to free fall into the abysmal hollow they were already in? My demons kept me company on my loneliest, bleakest days. But then my eyes would focus on the cinder blocks, covered in the writing of all the women housed in the cell before me. The words gave me strength and hope. Jesus was here. This too shall pass. Give your burdens to God. Praise God even when it's hard. The words reminded me to kneel down and pray every day. My praying became begging, Lord, please get me out of here in one solid piece. But I felt closer to Him than I had in all my life. That still didn't make solitary easy. It was agony to be away from loved ones, especially my spunky, full of life, 8-year-old daughter. I lost priceless experiences, dressing up her Barbie dolls, playing board games, and reading bedtime stories. All of them with happy endings. Instead, I had ended up in a place where someone told me when I could eat or shower, and if when I could speak to my child. Every day in the being, I wished I had not let the woman who picked on me mercilessly for weeks finally break me. Wish I had never snapped and hit her across her face with my green plastic cup, the act that got me sentenced to 20 days alone. Lying on the metal slab in a fetal position, facing the metal door as I waited for my next meal to arrive, I suddenly wondered whether the horrendous lingering odor that seemed to be following me around was me, my body decomposing, slowly dying inside. My baby is waiting for me, I kept repeating out loud. She needs to be saved. But first, I need to save another little girl, the one relegated to this cell. I had to survive my 20 days of 23-hour lockdown. If not for me, for my daughter. To do so, as the days turned to weeks, I traveled in my mind. I visited beautiful beaches in the Caribbean, deserts in the Middle East, rainforest in South America. I climbed rocky mountains and bathed in waterfalls. But most of the time I was on a white sandy beach, sitting on a comfy chair and a fruity drink with an umbrella in my hand, gazing into the distance to find that place where the sky ends and the ocean begins. My skin hungrily absorbed the heat of the raised sun. I closed my eyes, threw my head back, and smiled at the sun. I wanted to lie right on the sunburned sand and hug it, to feel the gratitude, for I was still alive, even as I was dying. And I knew I could fully come alive again one day, if I chose to. The sound of rolling wheels brought me back to the cell and away from the sun's rays and the sand. Lunch was coming down the corridor. I hoped it was something I could identify. If it was the mystery meat again, I'd have to eat the fruit I saved from the last few meals to carry me through dinner. I found the menu I created in my first couple of days in the being, picking out from the book I'd been reading earlier that morning, next to the calendar I had made to keep track of the days, which seemed to blend into one another. I never realized how I took calendars and clocks for granted before. In here, I had to track the sunlight and the arrival of meals to figure out what time of day it was. When it got dark after dinner, the time was much harder to figure out. I delighted in guessing the time and then checking the answer with the chaplain or one of the guards when they passed by during the rounds they made to check that none of us had hung ourselves. Lights were shut off promptly at 11 p.m. This is when the quiet sobbing became louder. It lasted all night, or until each of the crying women passed out from the exhaustion of begging to be let out. Sometimes I could hear the officers making fun of them. I had never followed a routine, but I made one on my second day in the being, and that structure gave me equilibrium. I exercised after breakfast, which was served at 4:30 a.m. They would come to shackle me up and escort me to take a shower around 10, so I made sure to complete my jumping jacks, sit-ups, squats, running in place by then. To get a sense of how long I actually ran, I would count to 60 over and over again. Tupac's song would run through my head as the tears welled up in my eyes. Please don't cry. Dry your eyes. Never let up. Forgive, but don't forget. Girl, keep your head up. And when he tells you you ain't nothing, don't believe him. I thought I could draw strength from one of my childhood idols. He spoke from his heart, and it spoke to mine. Keep your head up, Jackie. You're a soldier. I read 400-page books in 2 or 3 days and would trade them for markers when my pens ran out of ink so I could write poetry whenever I felt God speak to me. I might have been able to read even faster if I didn't have to steal light by standing up to hold the books to the small window where it shined in at night. It was a struggle, and there were times I wasn't sure I'd survive. But in hindsight, I would not exchange this experience for anything. If I had a second chance, I guess I would even hit the woman all over again, because that action landed me in the being, and my time there helped shape the woman I am today. Being in that cell taught me that I am far more resilient than I could have imagined. If I could survive that, there's not much more I can't. What seemed then like the end of my life was only the beginning of it, the start of doing things differently. A new me was born in that cell. By the time I successfully completed probation 5 years later, I had become a prison reform advocate, speaking up for all those women I left behind. Their cries remain with me as I fight, not with my fists anymore, but with my mind and heart. Voices of Solitude. Article 2. I'm homeless during the coronavirus pandemic, and I can't hold my newborn. By Paveli Rosario, May 5th, 2020. I'm originally from Orlando, Florida. At 19, I lost my mom, and since then, I've been a chronic homeless woman for 12 years, off and on. I'm 30 now. I first came to New York to escape an abusive relationship 2 years ago. Some people stay, I couldn't. Somewhere inside of me, I knew that I deserved better. As a survivor of domestic violence, I was really happy to get away and start a new life. I gave birth to my daughter on March 14th. She was born prematurely, so she's been in the NICU ever since. An already tough situation was made worse, given that we are now living amidst the coronavirus pandemic. I wanted to be able to breastfeed my daughter the way I know how, but they won't allow me because I take public transportation, and contact with her could put her at risk. I've only been able to hold my daughter once since the day she was born. Every day, I come to the hospital to bring her my milk. I ask about her weight. I ask when she's coming home, and I haven't gotten a definite answer. When I do get to see her, it's through glass. Since I can't even hold her, I feel like the bonding is lost. I named my daughter Kitana, inspired by my favorite character in the Mortal Kombat video game, because I felt like she is a fighter too. She's fighting for her life. Kitana's getting oxygen through a CPAP machine right now, and we're just waiting until she can breathe on her own. But I look at it this way. Even though I can't see her the way I want to, when I am able to, I know that I'm going to feel so good about it, like, oh wow, I gave birth to this beautiful girl. The funny part is, when I wear these masks, I think about how I named my daughter Kitana after a ninja. And these days, everybody on the street looks like a ninja. She came into this world in the time of the ninja. We're all fighting this together. It's a team effort. I've been staying in my current shelter since mid-January of this year. I have my own room. It's like a two-bedroom situation. Basically, I have my own refrigerator and my own bathroom, and I'm so grateful for that. I've also been fortunate to find a therapist who's the right fit, because some spirits agree with me and some don't. I found her through Floating Hospital, an amazing facility that provides healthcare to families in need at no cost. She's the best therapist I've ever had, and I couldn't do this without her. Other than that, I don't really have any confidants. It's just me. I made a choice a long time ago to remove negative people from my life. Maybe in some cases you can agree to disagree, but if those people are negative, remove them from your life and you'll prosper. Like I said, I'm a domestic violence survivor. I've had to leave friends down the road, or at least people I thought were my friends. So I've since realized that all I need is me. Whomever I need in the present moment, at that present time, they'll be there for me. Not being able to see my daughter is my biggest battle right now. I'm trying to remain calm because I believe fear can start all types of problems. I have to be strong for Kitana because she needs me. I take things day by day. I do this thing where I apply integers to my life, like math, to try to turn every negative into a positive. Doing that can be challenging, but I do like a challenge. I can't lie though, I'm suffering too. When I see the news, they're saying that people are dying from COVID-19 at the hospital where my daughter is. I pray and I hope that she won't catch the virus there. Because I mean, even the healthcare workers may not know that they're transferring it. What if they don't have to deal with a patient that's going through it and then see my daughter later on? I'm still questioning, how can I deal with this? Yes, my therapist is great. I've also been composing music, trying to help distract myself in a healthy way between the times that I get to visit her. I've been singing since I was 4 years old. We have a kitchen there, and I'm a great cook too. I burnt my mother's chicken once when I was young, and believe me, I haven't burned a chicken since. I would love to get stable housing because you need a solid foundation, a home. At some point in time, I'd like to do other things. I really want to help people, but of course, you've got to help yourself first in the process. More than anything, I want to be able to hold my daughter and let her latch on. In a couple of weeks, the doctors say it might happen. And I'm even grateful for that hope, too. Because during a time like this, who knows? Voices of Solitude. Article 3. CNN's Brooke Baldwin on having coronavirus. I was so lonely, my mind went to some dark places. By Brooke Baldwin, May 5th, 2020. You know when you go to work and you start feeling horrible, but you don't want to say it out loud because it almost gives it power to the fact that you are indeed getting sick? That was me. I didn't tell anyone, not even my producers. But suddenly I realized, I'm really freezing cold in this wool coat in my office. Something's not right. Initially, I wasn't panicked, and I didn't seriously consider it could be COVID-19 because I thought, I've been doing all the right things, social distancing, hand washing, plus I'm a journalist covering the coronavirus. What are the odds that I, of all people, could actually have it? Even after my husband put his hand on my forehead that afternoon and declared I definitely had a fever, later he'd confess he could have fried an egg on my head, even while I went to pour a test, I was still in denial. I was joking with the doctor. Mentally, I was focused on an interview I had scheduled later that week for the show with a nurse on the front lines. That's where my head was. Just days before, I'd posted a selfie on Instagram of me carrying pizza box down New York 6th Avenue, reflecting on how eerily empty the city was, worrying about the many people who were battling this virus. I had no idea that I would soon be one of them. I'm well acquainted with loneliness. In my 20s, working in the news, I moved around a lot, which meant not having many true friends wherever I lived. But now at 40 years old, settled in New York City, and married with an affectionate pug, it's been a while since I've really experienced loneliness. So when this virus took me down, in addition to the physical symptoms, the hardest and most unexpected part was how alone I felt. None of the people in my circle had dealt with this illness. In fact, many said I was the first person they knew who had COVID-19. There was no one who could relate, who would understand what the symptoms felt like, or where my state of mind was. Every day, a creeping dread would come over me as evening approached, because that's when the pain was the worst. I've never had pain in my lower extremities before, and it wasn't a common symptom most people described as part of this virus, but it was excruciating, and I couldn't anticipate how bad it could get on any given day. I spent up to an hour in a hot bath, sitting there trying to relieve the pain. Thank God for my husband. The doctor initially told us to stick to separate bedrooms and bathrooms while I was sick so I didn't expose him. That sounded good in theory, and we tried, but our separation lasted for 48 hours. I know, but day three or four, when the pain got really bad, that's when the constant tears started. My husband, bless him, couldn't just FaceTime with me from the couch in the living room as I sobbed nonstop. Finally, he came in, threw himself on me, and comforted me. He held me through my tears and whispered, "You're gonna be okay." Still beyond him, sweetly dropping off toast and tea, neither of which I could taste or smell, we tried to limit contact with one another and slept in separate bedrooms to protect him from exposure. I even tried to not touch our 17-year-old pug in case he could spread it to my husband. But after a few days, I just desperately needed my dog's kiss on my cheek to feel that some part of me was okay. During the long nights when I was alone, my mind went to some interesting but deep, dark places. Because you are stripped of self-expectations, stuff on a calendar, people being all up in your business, and you don't even have the strength to distract yourself with social media, you're basically just sitting with yourself. I was used to working, being on the go, constantly with a phone in my hand. Suddenly, I found myself very, very sick, sitting with myself in a way I hadn't been in a very long time. And in those moments, I was surprised to find myself thinking about joy. I kept asking myself, what would bring me joy after this? What does joy even mean to me? And why have I not done more to manifest joy in my life? Somehow, maybe because I'm from the South, I became obsessed with taking a trip to Charleston, South Carolina. I passed the time reading a freakish amount about the town because it helped me imagine being on the other side, what I would do when I got there. I also spent a lot of time talking to my mom, encouraging her to lean into the joy in this moment when I couldn't, pushing her to work out and get on that treadmill like she'd been meaning to, and she did. The solitude also taught me that it's okay to be vulnerable. I listened to and read a lot of Brené Brown during this time, and she has this great quote: "Staying vulnerable is a risk we have to take if we want to experience connection." She and this experience showed me that it's okay to let my husband take care of me, to call my friends and tell them how I'm feeling, to need a hug from my pug, to feel like everything is going to be all right. Whether you're dealing with this virus, you're lonely, or just going through a hard time, people will show up for you if you let them. I didn't grow up using FaceTime, but now I'm used to the idea that if I call a loved one to see their face, even if I haven't washed my hair in 4 or 14 days, they will be happy to keep me company. Once I felt better, I said I'd been to hell and back. Now I want to take that back. I'm aware that what I went through was a cakewalk compared to what so many people are dealing with. Today, I interviewed a 30-something-year-old woman whose husband died of the virus alone. I'm incredibly lucky that I survived, that I have a chance and a caring partner that means to get a test and access to technology to stay in touch with family via Zoom. I don't feel sorry for myself at all, but when I look back at what I went through, I realize that my world did change. Everyone's journey will be different. For anyone who's alone right now, what worked for me was making a list, not just mentally, but actually writing it down of things that will bring me happiness, like planning that someday trip to South Carolina or talking to my mom more. I also believe music is a healer of all things. During the quarantine, I started doing The Class by Taryn Toomey, a woman-run spiritual fitness class. Their music is bomb, and I was doing it every day while quarantining. But after I got sick, I would stream The Class from my bed just to hear the music and feel inspired. I finally returned to work this week after testing negative for the virus. Just before I went on the air for my first show back, I was surprised to find my palms were sweaty, I never get nervous anymore, but this entire ordeal has been emotional for me for a million reasons, and I was a little anxious about being vulnerable. That word again, live on television about what I had gone through. There I was alone again, this time in front of the mirror. Before the pandemic, I attended two of the stops on Oprah's 2020 Vision Tour. And I looked at my reflection and found myself yelling the mantra from that tour. Words that at that time I had no idea would be exactly what I would soon need to tell myself. I can, I will, watch me. That is it for now. Thank you for listening to Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed the articles. If you have any questions or comments, please call 210-829-4223. This is Dee saying goodbye from our radio.